We stand at a moment of time of extreme political polarization, and I can understand that we fight over things like guns and abortion, but it seems unfathomable that we're also fighting over things that, you know, everybody needs, like childcare. And to us, it just seems like kids' issues should be something that can be a North Star in our politics.
I couldn't agree more, Bruce. And we'll be getting into this report shortly. But our guest today, Abby McCluskey, was tasked through the Convergence Collaborative on Supports for Working Families, putting together a report, In This Together, a cross-partisan action plan to support families with young children in America, which I think outlines some comprehensive ways that we can work together to advance the lives of children and families.
I was pleased to be a part of that report, and I think one of the key findings that we found is that most people aren't partisan. Partisan drives the outrage machine, but what we really need is a conversation, and the convergence process really brought that together. From First Focus on Children, this is Speaking of Kids. I'm Bruce Leslie.
And I'm Marcella Chalubi. Speaking of Kids is a podcast that puts kids at the center of public policy.
I think that one thing that people don't really know necessarily about First Focus on Children is that we are a bipartisan organization, and we really strive to work with pretty much anybody, whether they're Democrats, Independents, Republicans, who agreed to do right by kids. And sometimes that really creates some strange bedfellows where you find supporters from areas that you sometimes are surprised by. And other times it's just a matter of, just trying to get to the votes. And so we'll strive for the greatest thing possible for kids. But if what we can get at the moment in time is, just enough votes to get us across the finish line, and it's an incremental step, and it's not everything we want, we'll take it. We want progress. What we don't want is backsliding, and so we constantly and vigilantly fight that.
Yeah, and I think where this really comes into play, especially at an organization like First Focus on Children, is because we work on the cross of issues, I think over the years, and Bruce, it'd be interesting to get your take, is on individual issues, you see some progress being made or some unique players that are willing to see the issue through the lens of children and families and take action and movement, whereas that's not always the case on other issues. Like, for example, we may get movement and traction on some issues related to early childhood and make incremental progress. But other issues like immigration, we recognize that some are more controversial than others.
No, absolutely. And then it does create some really weird situations sometimes, like even in the area of homelessness, for example, the adult groups in that space actually see kids as a threat because they think that if we really start dealing with child homelessness in this country, then all the money will flow to kids and then adults will get nothing. And so we see outright opposition from some homeless groups on helping children who are homeless. There's this weird politics in our country. And at this time, more than ever, opposition comes up just for the sake of opposition. And it's unproductive and it doesn't really move the ball forward.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think what surprised me on an issue that we've picked up and worked on a little bit in a more meaningful way recently is even nutrition, child nutrition. I mean, players that you would really think should come around this very simple concept, right? It's like, let's give our kids good food. Let's give them, access to good food over the summertime. Let's provide certain families and children with meals. Things that should just be no-brainers, like anyone that you just ask, regardless of race, regardless of, political affiliation, that should just be something that we do because it makes sense and it benefits us as a society. You get pushback or, it requires work, right? It requires creativity on different players' parts and there's not a desire. And, to the point that you mentioned earlier is how can we set a structure where we're allowing children to be our North Star.
The kind of thing right in front of our face that's coming up this summer, and I think we'll do a podcast on this in the near future, is summer meals. So kids get food through the school year, but in the summers, we see a huge uptick in child hunger. And so one of the great things that the federal government has done is said, we'll actually run this summer meals program, and it's called the Summer EBT program. and they made it available to states. And 35 states immediately took it up, and 15 outright rejected it. And they say, yeah, we don't think that kids really need that. And, you know, to pick on Governor Jeff Landry from Louisiana for a moment, his state ranks 49th in child well-being, and he's rejected the money. And it's like, Governor, like, of all things, like, I think it just seems like something we can all agree on is that children should not have to go to bed hungry at night. And apparently, Governor Landry thinks that's somehow a positive thing. It's just dumbfounding to me.
Yeah. I think for First Focus in particular, it does lend itself to, you know, dealing with a lot of unique characters and industries depending on the issue. And at the end of the day, you know, I think really what we do need more than ever now are people that can push politics aside and really create bipartisan solutions around issues that are fundamental to children, to the country's future, to families, you know, because there's value in different perspectives. And with that, you know, you can get to a compromise and really move policy that has an impact to change the lives of millions of children and families.
No, absolutely. And for that purpose, it's really great. We have our guest today is Abby McCloskey, and she did a project for Convergence, and they brought together people from the left and the right, conservatives and progressives, to sort of talk about something that really centered children and families. And so she really posed the question of how do we cause children and families to flourish? And by doing so and really making the people and the kids and families the center, it really did drive a conversation and a discussion that really came up with some concepts and ideas of ways to move the country forward. So I'm really excited to getting into this with Abby today and the final report that was produced by Convergence, that it really does have some solid recommendations for improving the lives of kids and families.
Yes, Abby did not have a small task in front of her. She had this mandate to pull these groups together, individuals together, and produce this report.
Yeah.
Abby McCloskey is founder and principal of McCloskey Policy LLC, a research and consulting firm servicing business and political leaders across the country. She is a columnist for the Dallas Morning News and impact leader for Politico's Women's Rural Exchange.
So, Abby, thanks so much for joining us today. We're so glad to have you.
I'm so glad to be here.
I love a lot of your writing. I particularly wanted to talk to you about an op-ed you wrote in the Dallas Morning News. It was entitled, "Our Kids Are Not Okay, Neither Is Our Child Policy." And it's something we say all the time at First Focus on Children. And so I was like, oh my gosh. And I'd just gotten to know you. I mean, I had seen your work before, but we had just met. And so I was like psyched to read it. And I shared it with everybody I knew and on social media. In it, you talked about how children are in crisis and about how kids are facing unique challenges today. And it really spoke to me and I think to our listeners as well. And so tell us about your thoughts and what drove you to write an op-ed for the Dallas Morning News, but you've also been published, you know, this year in Politico and other places. So what is your thinking behind that framing and sort of your conclusions in those pieces?
Yeah, Bruce, I don't know if you know this, but you actually inspired the piece because a while ago in a conversation that you and I had before we knew each other very well, you mentioned the 1991 National Commission on Children report, which I knew of vaguely, but had not gone through it. And in the report, there's this question posited, are children better off? And essentially, the commission comes to this conclusion that children actually aren't better off at this point in 1990 than they would have been in 1970. And this is particularly the case for low-income kids. And they use this great phrase of being in double jeopardy, like the kids who are at the most risk of falling behind academically are in the worst performing schools. The kids who are at the highest health risk are like have the least access to the types of preventative and supportive medical care that they would need. And that report, which had been kind of lost in the sands of time, which is a strange and sad thing about policy and ideas, also was what set the stage for the child tax credit, which is something I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with and something that's still being debated today. But the inception of that idea was from this bipartisan group 30 years ago. And so the nature of the piece, I mean, part of it, Bruce, is I'm a columnist. This is my local paper. And so I have to write a piece every other Sunday. Yeah, but the reason why I wrote this one was because I, through other work I have been thinking about, we haven't had a national commission on children. We haven't had this national pulse. I mean, different groups do it and foundations. We haven't had that type of, it's in law. It's, you know, its members are appointed by the president. We're going to have a pretty formal readout of how kids are faring. We haven't done that since then. And as I was imagining what such a commission now would find, I think the data is also pretty condemning that some of these trend lines that they point out, like that there's 20% of kids born to unmarried mothers, and now we have 40% of kids born to unmarried mothers. Or, you know, they talk about the spike in mental health challenges among kids, that 5% of kids were depressed and anxious in 1991. And I'll give a shameless plug to Jonathan Haidt's new book, which came out yesterday, of The Anxious Generation. Like, now anxious and unsettled kids is like an epidemic in America. The day when it's only 5% would be considered a success, not kind of an indicator of a problem. You could go across any number of dimensions, academic performance. We talked a lot during the pandemic about the, in many ways, what seems like it'll be a permanent loss of educational outcomes among our most vulnerable kids. But what that glossed over is the fact of, we've been having challenges in academic performance for decades. The pandemic exacerbated it, but we're having problems other than that. And of course, childcare costs inflating faster than incomes. And I was talking to a friend about the piece. One of the benefits of writing for your local paper is you get a lot of feedback from neighbors, oh, I don't know, grocery store goers and friends, of course. And one of my friends, who's a mother herself of three kids, was like, you know, Abby, I really wanted like your piece. And I found it depressing. Like, you know, next time you write something like that, let's, you know, maybe think about having a redemptive arc or something more happy at the end of it, which I get. And at the end, I did provide a set of recommendations about how to push the well-being of kids forward in the conversation. And the reality is, though, like, to get to that redemptive point or the point where the story has a happy ending, we do have to look pretty squarely in the data of how kids are faring. And here we are, the wealthiest the country's ever been, the most kind of educated, enlightened, advanced, use, you know, pick your word. And our kids are doing really terribly along some of our most basic indicators. And to me, that's as good of a call to action as any.
Yeah. I really loved it. And so I would disagree with your neighbor, because I think that one of the things I really have liked about, you know, the different columns you've written is that my wife has a phrase where she talks about, you know, stop admiring the problem. And I think that's what's important, is that we have to tell people about the problem, because most people think kids are fine and not. And so we have to tell them, no, kids are in crisis, and you do a great job of going through, you know, some of the metrics of what's going on. But also, you don't just admire the problem. And so what I really loved is that you had some very concrete recommendations. And you talked about like changing government structures to elevate the voice and needs of children, which I thought was great. You talked about, I think, a very important issue, which is ways to cross the political divide. And you talk about political polarization, and I think in both of them, and how we really do need to find common ground and really get kids' issues back in that bipartisan space where they have been historically. And then also your shared vision of health, you know, and as you said earlier about, you know, really making sure that children and families are set up to flourish, right? And which I think is a great word and perfect. So we'll get into the convergence process shortly, but I just wanted your, you know, you to sort of elaborate on those recommendations and any other thoughts you have along those lines.
Yeah, something you were saying, Bruce, stuck out to me. One of the perennial challenges with elevating kids' needs is that the time period in which parents have young kids is so limited before they're on to something else. So there's just a natural cramped nature of the discussion. But I also think something is like, when you're in it, and I'm in it, like young kids, there's this feeling something you're doing wrong, or you could be doing better. This is like your own problem to fix. And I think it's really, in some ways, like a breath of fresh air to be like, oh no, wait, actually, whether it's there not being sidewalks in our neighborhood, or what's happening with kind of an uncontrolled tech landscape, or kind of access to different schools. Most people can't afford one other than the one that's right down the road from them. That these are big things. And these are things that could be fixed and could be changed. On the recommendations for how to change, whether it's workplace culture, our public policies. I do think it's really important to elevate the problem, as you were saying. And the most basic way I could think of would be to have a reconvening of the National Commission on Children for 2024, 2025. Like, to actually have a bipartisan discussion, it has to be that, because we're so polarized right now that to only have one political party lead that conversation, it would be very difficult, I think, for that to be representative of how most parents feel and for the solutions that would come out of that to be sustainable and have broad-based buy-in. I think we've been fighting politically about so many things, but in family policy for so long, about whether it's kind of what happens in the aftermath of Dobbs or childcare, should parents stay home, should they work full time, or we've had kind of all these political battles. I think we have really lost a vision for what a good and flourishing childhood look like in America, like what's possible. And maybe it's because I tend to be a pessimist in nature, but sometimes it's easier to get to that by looking at what we have now and saying it's not that. So like that gives us a vision of what we don't want, because clearly this isn't working on a lot of dimensions, but what do we want? And that was some of the work that we did at the Convergence Group, Bruce, you and I were part of. But I think that's a really big question that we haven't been asking. And I get that maybe because the challenges are so great, it feels more like whack-a-mole with what's right in front of us for each, you know, different policy lever or challenge. But maybe some bigger thinking about what do healthy, happy, well-being, connected, relationally secure kids, like how can we move in that direction as a society? Government's probably part of it, but also what does that mean for employers and neighbors and family members and the rest of it too?
Yeah, I love that. And I really like your framing around, you know, how can we as a society really come together on some of these issues? Sometimes I feel like it's organized in abandonment of families, and that it's very purposeful, and it's frustrating, because I think as a parent, I always felt this way. I don't know if the two of you feel this way, but I always felt that right when I got an age down, right? Like you learn your two-year-old, you know, and they're going through terrible twos, and you're like, okay, I finally figured out. Well, now they're three, you know, and then the next thing you know, they're going through puberty, and you're like, what is this? You know, and so it's so important to have people and structures to rely on to sort of get through those periods and people's advice, because it's not, there's not a playbook, you know, and it's not inherent.
Yeah. And it's never been done in a more kind of isolated way than we're doing now. Like this is actually extremely new. And I think the hands-off mentality, part of it could be described in a negative way. Part of it might be like, hey, we know everybody has different preferences and family values. We don't want to step on anyone's toes, kind of Wild West, like do what you want. Also results in not providing a lot of supports for families. But I think that type of approach is more doable when there are healthy and strong families and well-connected communities, and there is income security. And that kind of approach paired with what families are facing today, it is just emptiness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these issues are also very comprehensive. And that's what I love about the work of, you know, First Focus, and just the nature of this report too, is that these are issues that require tackling several issues at the same time. And I think what's, you know, interesting to me is how siloed everything is right now. And so you may have, you know, as it relates to engaging members and just trying to shift the political frame on certain things, we just get stuck on these issues. But when you really think about, to your point, what do families really need? When you get to those universal basic principles, it helps ground people, or at least creates some level of baseline understanding around, you know, what's necessary to really move forward, and really examining current structures and saying, hey, at least we know this is not it, you know, so what do we want? So tell us a little bit about the convergence process that you led, and Bruce, you served as a member of. Abby, were you optimistic that you could find some common ground here in a very politically polarized environment?
No, but that's partly just my disposition. So the nature of the group, and because we talked about the 1991 National Commission on Children, was almost unofficial way to put together something that really closely resembled that, even though it's not appointed by the president and in congressional legislation. But we had a similar number of folks. We brought together 32 people, and a similar striving to have political balance, because I think we've at least in the policy world, a lot of us have been in groups where it's like a progressive group with a token liberal or a conservative group with a token progressive. And we wanted it to be really ideologically balanced. And because government is a big part of this, but not the only part, we wanted to have a group that had employers at the table and childcare providers and physicians and people from across the country instead of just inside the DC Beltway to round out the discussion. And I was anxious going into it that when I asked people like Bruce, he would say, you know, no, or wouldn't see the value in it. Everyone who we asked, I think except one person, signed on. And then the first meeting, we all came together. Many of us had never met each other in person before. Others had been together in person, but testifying against each other in a hearing or being in the green room to go against each other on cable news. And I loved what you were saying, because the first discussion was not at all about policy. It was coming together to talk about what does family flourishing look like. And at that point, I really became unoptimistic as a Bruce, because once we started opening that up, it felt like we had to talk about everything. And all of a sudden, everything was on the table. It's like, well, this is too much to bite off. And, you know, that kids of all ages have different struggles. Or what about dependents who are old? Or what about people who want to work but can't work? We had these really wide-ranging discussions about how do we even scope this and narrow down our focus? And what even is kind of the North Star, the flourishing that we'd be going after? And that was probably one of my lowest points, was leaving that first meeting, because it felt so scattered, broad, unfocused. But in retrospect, I think starting there and having those conversations, which I'd categorize as more like right brain conversations and creative and visionary and outside of all the specific policy things that we argue all day long, really helped gel the group and the people together and actually did give us shared language and a vision for what we were going for. And that made all the conversations that came after it, remotely and in person, so much richer. And, you know, I think in the same way that I've experienced some of the current polarization as really problematic to supporting families and kids, I think a lot of us have experienced that, doesn't matter which side of the aisle you sit on. And there is a hunger to not be stopped by politics when it comes to solving these issues. And so people hung on for really long Zoom meetings, for in-person meetings, for track-changing documents for the 12th time. There was an energy from the group, I think a recognition of the importance of A, just humanizing each other and getting to know each other, and B, saying, man, if we can't figure out what to do, then how on earth would we expect an institution that's public, things like that, like Congress, to be able to come together in this way and put forward consensus solutions?
Coming up after the break, Abby shares the concrete recommendations that came out of the convergence process.
Stick around.
Making the world a better place for all children can seem like an impossibly huge task. Some of you may be thinking, I'm just one person. What could I possibly do to make a difference? I'm Leila Nimatala, Vice President of Advocacy and Mobilization at First Focus on Children. And I'm inviting you to join us and become one of our volunteer advocates, whom we call our Ambassadors for Children. Ambassadors are our most active child advocates who raise critical issues with the U.S. Congress and with the administration related to child policy and funding decisions, both for kids in the U.S. and worldwide. But don't take my word for it. We asked one of our ambassadors to share her experience.
Hello, my name is Annette Bridges, also known as Dr. B, and I live in Louisville, Kentucky. The welfare of children and their families is a deep concern for me, and really always has been, especially those from marginalized communities. I care about equity in education, resources, and health. And I'm not quite sure what it's going to take for our elected officials to invest in our children, and I mean fully invest in our children. It really boils down to the haves and have-nots. It's a selfish attitude if an elected official does not consider children as a priority. I say selfish because, if you think about it, other countries with less resources can provide universal preschool as an option for families. Then why is it that our country can't do that as well? I am proud to be an ambassador for First Focus on Children because they are serious about the work they have done, are doing, and will do in the near future. Their efforts are relentless. Think about being an ambassador for them, being a voice for the voiceless. I can't think of anything else more worthy. Thanks for listening, and it's been my pleasure to talk about what is near and dear to my heart, and that is children. Thank you for your time.
So please join us, won't you? Check out campaignforchildren.org/ambassadors on how to become a First Focus on Children ambassador and to link up with our fabulous community of committed child advocates.
First Focus on Children is a bipartisan advocacy organization dedicated to making children and families the priority in federal policy and budget decisions.
First Focus on Children moves beyond individual issues to serve a more important role, child advocacy. We educate lawmakers and the American public about the issues facing children.
To learn more about our work and ways that you can become an ambassador, go to firstfocus.org.
Coming up on our State of Play, Masalich and I are going to talk about some of the issues that are confronting kids and families at this moment in time.
It's interesting because I know Bruce very well, and you know he's been a part of several of these conversations and outlets where you really get people to try to come around and brainstorm. We're part of so many different coalitions, and I think it is still unique to have a group of thought leaders at this caliber really come together to check all that. Because again, the one thing that I appreciate about the work that we do as an organization is it's really not about, you know, what side of the aisle you're on. Like, as long as you're looking to move forward and advance the needs of kids, like, we'll work with you. And so because we work on the cross, we're able to, you know, have certain people that are great on certain issues. But what I loved about the report was that it really centered families that are at their most critical point. You know, I'm in this window, right, where this 0 to age 8, where there's so many things that happen in life, where in terms of delivery and outcomes, my son was in the NICU for 3 weeks. I mean, no one really prepares you for that. And I'm so grateful, you know, similarly to you, to have worked at an organization that provided paid family leave. But still, so many people across the country, I mean, to put your mindset into a family that doesn't really have that as an option at a window in time when you're spending so much and just mentally, you know, kids that at that age, I really did appreciate the focus on families in that age group, and then also low to moderate income families that, again, if you don't have these additional supports and wraparounds, it's a very difficult window to get through as a family and, you know, by default as a community and as a country. Can you tell us about, you know, the recommendations that the group made for these families?
Yeah, I'd love to. And thanks for saying those nice words about the process. So we did have some broad right brain and what's flourishing talk, but we have some pretty concrete suggestions. So there were 4 baskets of recommendations, and intentionally the first was narrative change. And it was part of play on that 1991 report by the National Commission on Children is called Beyond Rhetoric, kind of with the vibes of, hey, we've been talking about the problem, let's solve it. But something that our group kept coming back to, even though very few of us, if any of us, were PR communications experts, were saying, no, the language and like narratives around what it's like to have a kid in this country are kind of exacerbating the problem and making it difficult to have political will to do things. Narratives like having a kid is like, you know, buying a car, you bought it, like you're responsible for it, society has no responsibility for you. Or that we've run out of money. And as an economist, like I very much empathize with our fiscal conservatives on the situation, but that maybe there's no way we could better spend existing resources to support kids and families, which is not necessarily true. And so this leading with the narrative change section and saying, how can we shift to a more productive conversation that puts the well-being of kids at the front? And practically, how do we do that? It had things like a PR campaign, which is what's happening in the UK right now. It's a campaign called Shaping Us. Again, building political will to support early childhood and recognition of what a crucial time it is. We had a recommendation for a cross-partisan database because we're in a period where even government data is distrusted by certain groups. And so how can there actually be a set of indicators and poll and data that, whether you're in a really progressive organization, a really conservative organization, you could look at that and say, like, yes, that gives a pulse for how families are doing that we buy into and can move forward with and try to change. And then what had come up earlier, we also have just actual structures in Congress or the administration or at state or local level that are explicit about their focus on children. Another recommendation we had, which has been very much in the news lately, was rethinking cash support for families. The child tax credit is the biggest support that the federal government gives to families. It was what was kind of seeded in that 1991 Commission on Children report. We had a lot of discussions about that, which has had a long bipartisan history, but more recently has been kind of caught up in some of these partisan conversations. And one thing that our group elevated, which I think was really important, was working within like the time flexibility of the existing tax credit. So if you can claim the full amount of the CTC, which is a point of discussion and disagreement that more people should be able to claim it. But if you can claim the full amount, it's $2,000 every year when a child's between the ages of 0 and 17, which is $32,000. And what would happen if a family could pull $10,000 of that into the first year? You're not talking about, in that case, additional spending. You're talking about families being able to better use what they're already getting. Another thing we looked at was childcare. And again, an area with a long history of bipartisan support, CCDBG in particular, which is the block grants that go to states for childcare, is a robust program, our biggest form of childcare support. And yet also maybe some back and forth about childcare being thought of reflexively as center-based care versus what about the churches that want to provide care, which there was some tension with and Build Back Better, or what about parents being home to provide care? And what's the opposite side of care is like, what are workplaces like? Can they let kids come and be down the hall every now and again? Can you leave at a predictable time during the day? Or is your schedule like dictated with enough time for you to childcare? So we talked about childcare in a broader way, I think, and Bruce could assist than some of the other explicit childcare groups do, and talked about it as a more, can we have a more holistic care conversation about young kids? Because it's not just, even if you work full-time and you're child is in center-based care, they're still at home with you certain times. And if you stay home, you still have babysitters and mom's day out programs. There's everyone's kind of a mix of all these things. And can we talk about it in a more holistic way and how all the pieces fit together better? And the last piece, and the most specific I think we were able to get throughout the entire report, was to explicitly call for a 12-week paid parental leave plan. And there were no words minced in this section. It was that what mothers and infants are facing is unacceptable. We have rising maternal and infant mortality rates for the first time in modern American history, and that it should be the most basic of protections, that if you work and you have a baby and you choose to be with that baby, both in their vulnerable time and in the mother's case, the healing, and in the father's case, or whatever the status of the family is, to be able to have that time protected for the health, economic well-being, attachment, socialization, like you name it, to have that time protected is something that the United States sorely lacks. And that is the longest duration of a bipartisan paid parental leave plan that I've seen put forward. And I'm just really hopeful that that piece that people can pick up and run on it. And there is a bipartisan, bicameral paid leave working group right now in Congress in the midst of a 2024 election year and all that entails, that kind of here we are in a random part of a congressional hall. There's a group that meets and is trying to solve this. But yeah, for me, I think this is probably the most actionable thing at the federal level that could happen in short order. But also things like, how do we have more community supports for parents and kids in home visiting? How do we just innovations like maybe Medicaid? You should be allowed to do that via telemedicine if you're pregnant or have a newborn and you can't get time off of work or get transportation to go. Like, how can we kind of, and this was really the spirit of the endeavor and the conversation I'd love to have, is like, how can we kind of break it out if we talk about these kind of individualized policy silos and we're kind of nipping and tucking the programs that exist? Like, how can we actually rethink what this looks like in a way that makes sense for people with young kids? And that was the nature of what we were trying to bring in this report.
I would add what I'm really almost most excited about is that I think the way you sort of helped lead the group and where we all sort of ended up on with is so often we complain that when there's debates around kids and families, they're actually not centered. We watch debates all the time or articles, newspaper articles, et cetera, where there's a conversation about kids. An example would be, you know, foster care. Mm. And they talk about the parents and they talk about the social workers and the police and the, you know, the judges. And you're like, you know, this is about the kids. Like, yeah. You know, did it occur to anyone to sort of ask their opinion? And because kids know, right? And they know what's probably best for them often. And it's not to say that their opinion should decide, but God, you know, we don't ask. And so what I really love is that so much of the report really does center children and families. And so it's what is it they need? It is hard work to be a parent. And so how can we make that just a little easier and just a little less stressful? And I think that many of the recommendations in the report really drive that home. And I think that it was such a great process. And I think it really does show that at the end of the day, once you sort of get past all the polarization, that people do think that we should, you know, do a little bit better, you know, at least by children and families. And I would echo your point on it's really great that there's a family medical leave group on a bipartisan basis on the Hill. And then also the House, you know, just passed an expansion
That's
of the
right.
child tax credit, right, on a very bipartisan That's right. way. So I do have hope, and I'm a glass half empty kind of person. So
I mean, and you've been around DC for, you know, longer than I, Bruce, and these things kind of cycle when issues kind of come into yeah. public awareness, try as you might to want to keep them there all the time. And it felt like during the pandemic, there was tremendous amount of focus on this because of childcare closures and school closures. But it feels like to me, because the data is becoming just so overwhelming, that kids are not okay. Like we see it with John yeah. Hite's new book. You see it with Melissa Carney's new book about the two-parent privilege. You see it about Tim Carney's new book, Family Unfriendly. Like, there's such a drumbeat of like, wait a second, this isn't just kind of feelings and kind of snowflake parents and, you know, we can always try to do better, like kind of buck up. This is actually like our kids are not well. We can't keep kicking this can down the road. And I think that is driving this to the front of the conversation and why we're seeing these bipartisan actions, why we're seeing these pilots at the state level, why we're kind of, I think, beginning to see more parents push back and reach out about it, because it's just, again, at least from an academic point of view, the data is pretty overwhelming that if we keep riding out the trend lines that we're on, it's not going to be great. It's already not great.
Well, it is beautiful to just have this conversation take shape in a way that both of you, I feel like, left it a little bit more optimistic. And I feel like the fact that Bruce is feeling good about this is saying a lot, you know, because I think oftentimes it's hard to get people to put their guard down and
yeah.
and put their organizational priorities, their, you know, personal opinions and thoughts kind of to the side, just to say, well, how can we just do better, period, right? And it also is all interconnected. You know, it's hard to look at one area in isolation. And so I love that. But I know some days it may get really frustrating. And so on those days, you know, I'm sure Bruce mentioned that we are compiling a playlist. What do you listen to kind of just make you get back to feeling like you got this?
Music is such a huge part of my life. And I don't know if we've talked about that before, Bruce, but I am a classically trained pianist and I sing on a band. And music is kind of my go-to to unwind. And anyhow, I have been going back into my like old piano books from middle school and high school and relearning some of the pieces I knew back then, like Debussy and Clair de Lune and Sinding's Rustles of Spring and all these beautiful classic pieces, which are the pieces that I'm playing around the house or working on and kind of consume a lot of my mental energy. But I was thinking about that with that question because it made me realize as I'm flipping through these old books and seeing all the notes from my piano teachers over the years. And the fact that this was something that started when I was really young. I think I started taking lessons when I was 6. I took them through college. This is not a skill you can pick up late in life. This is just yet another of the many examples of how like what happens in our childhood impacts what kind of adults we become. And now I'm playing those songs for my kids and and they're in piano. And yeah, for me, it's just kind of been this, in addition to just all the joy I get from classical music in particular, and especially Debussy is my favorite right now. What a testament to the importance of childhood and yeah, the seeds that are planted us when we're so young, kind of staying with us even here in middle age. So I don't know if you want Claire de Lune on your playlist, although it is beautiful. So maybe you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be on there. No, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
We'll start with Afrobeat and then end with,
end with that as people are falling asleep.
I love it.
Well, Abby, so thank you so much for joining us and also for your outstanding work and really appreciate all your leadership. And you pulled a very diverse set of people together, and that was very quite impressive.
Oh, well, thank you, Bruce, for saying yes to the group and for both of y'all for having me on. It's such a joy. Thank you.
All right, Bruce. So for today's State of Play, we're really going to be talking about how we're at a crossroads. There's really a need now more than ever to really come together and to develop bipartisan solutions. And, you know, what I'm alluding to is in June of 2022, the Dobbs decision was announced, which overturned Roe v. Wade. And we're now living in a new era as it relates to women's health, children's health, and family supports. And so, you know, on one end, we have this controversial ruling. To balance this, we need to think about what are our policies and supports and programs around maternal health and family supports and children's health. And just the need for people across the aisle to work together now more than ever. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's always been a huge problem and desperately needing attention. But now more than ever, because of this decision, the states that have banned reproductive freedom are, as a New York Times story that we'll put in the show links has demonstrated, are the very states that have the worst maternal child health policies in the country. And so, as Abby talked about, and she and I are both from Texas, is that, you know, we really do need attention to bipartisan solutions in a lot of ways. But I would say, like, even in terms of just maternal child health, like, there needs to be an awakening about, you know, you can't ban reproductive freedom and then not be concerned about the crazy, ridiculous, horrifying, outrageous maternal and infant mortality problem in this country. And you know, I'll just point out that the House of Representatives were considering massive cuts to WIC, eliminating a lot of maternal child health programs, including a program called Healthy Start that was a George Bush initiative to reduce, you know, maternal and infant mortality.
These services were already arguably pretty weak, right? Like they yeah. needed additional resources. And as we heard from one of our previous guests, Dr. Kirabo Jackson, money does matter in education, but then across the board as it relates to children and families and maternal health. And so what do you think are some steps that the report that Abby led and that you were a part of that team to really, you know, highlight some solutions? What do you think is needed right now?
I mean, I think that the Convergent report is a great step. And Abby also talked about the National Commission on Children's study back in 1991. And we really need something huge like that at this moment in time and have people come together. We should be making investments in maternal child health. We talked in episode 7 about WIC. We should be fully funding WIC for moms and babies and making sure that we not only start healthy, but stay healthy for kids and moms. And we talked in episode 9 with Dr. Mona and Professor Schaefer about their initiative in Flint, Michigan that was just, you know, is amazing. And it's basically giving assistance and supports to moms and babies to have better outcomes, right? And, you know, in episode 11, we talked about the child tax credit, and that shows sort of the, you know, I don't want to use the word hypocrisy, but, you know, it may apply here, which is that, well, cut your child tax credit because you're having a baby. None of that makes sense. We really have to come to a better solution in this country for kids. And we had talked earlier, there's 15 states in this country that could feed kids in the summer months. And Governor Landrieu in Louisiana and other states, including my state, Texas, Governor Abbott have just refused to take the money and just are fine with leaving kids hungry. It's just not acceptable.
I agree with you. I think the whole issue, it doesn't add up, right? Like, you just want to ask somebody, make it make sense to me. These were bipartisan efforts because they understood that you have to balance things. And that's not necessarily taking shape anymore. They're just being disregarded or defunded or cut without really understanding the impact these programs have.
Yeah, and in just so many ways, this stuff is so critically important, particularly like at that moment in time, at the time of birth, that's the group of kids in this country that have the highest poverty rate. I mean, it's actually the highest poverty rate in this country of any age group is children 0 to 3. And that's just not right. It's at that moment of time we should actually be providing all the more supports. And we as a nation are doing the opposite, and we're not providing family paid leave. We're not providing childcare, and we really aren't making the investments in things like maternal child health and the child tax credit, and et cetera, that we should be doing.
And I think that's why it's more important now than ever for people listening and for our ambassadors around the country, for them to really call their members of Congress and just ask, you know, what is your policy on this? How does this help children and families? And if there is a push for one side, there needs to be balance on the other. To your point, you can't change reproductive rights that impact millions of women across the country and families across the country, but then not offer supports on the other side and actually, in fact, trying to cut them on the other side. It's just a recipe for disaster. Our work is far from over. We have a lot of work to do. And I think now more than ever, the level of education and awareness that we bring to members and their staffers is so critical.
This is Speaking of Kids. Thanks for listening. I'm Bruce Leslie.
And I'm Marcella Jalubi. Special thanks to our guest, Abby McCluskey.
Speaking of Kids is a podcast by First Focus on Children.
Elizabeth Windham is the supervising producer, and Julia Windham is the associate producer.
Layla Nimitala is the advocacy and mobilization producer, and the senior producer is Jay Woodward.
Our theme music is Don't Look Twice by Sam Barsh.
For more information about this week's episode, go to firstfocus.org. You can find our links in our show notes.
If you have any thoughts, questions, or interests in becoming a First Focus on Children ambassador, email us at speakingofkids@firstfocus.org.
And please follow, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
Speaking of Kids is produced by Windhaven Productions and Blue Jay Atlantic.